Champion Report, the place where the news is never hidden and the truth always wins. Today I have Claire Lopez joining me. She's sharing about Iran's involvement in 9/11. My question is, why is this not every day being talked about? Why wasn't it talked about for years? It's been hidden for political agendas to be achieved. You're going to see that, and you're going to have to come out and say what's going on. Today's show is going to blow your mind. What I have today is a number of interesting pieces that will just blow your mind. And after that, we're going to get into the news. But this is a Christian show, and I want to start with a reading from God's Word. So let me get to that real quick. My goal here is in sharing Christianity, this is a Christian, again, a Christian news show, that I achieve part of the purpose, which is sharing the gospel. So let me read from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 to 21. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the prudent, the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Well, verse 18 refers to those that perish. Who are they? Those that die without a relationship with Christ. Where do they go? Hell. The preaching of Christ is having offered his life freely for the price of sins, your sins and mine. It is everything. It's the very power of God for God to take on this miraculous payment for the burden of payment for our sins. Christ's blood shed on the cross paid that price. There are some with self-proclaimed knowledge that they know better. They may claim that this never happened, yet it's part of the historical record that Jesus was crucified. You can find it in many different historical records. It's just kind of shocking how many. They may claim, again, that this never happened, but it's part of historical record that he died and he was buried. It's also part of the historical record that changes wrought in people's lives who believe in Jesus. They believe that he died on the cross and he rose again, offering his blood as a sacrifice for their sins. Think about that. That's the historical record. Preaching is sharing the gospel, preaching the truth that Christ sacrificed for our sins. Preaching is not always done from a pulpit or by a person who is preaching to a crowd. It's done every time a person shares the good news of Christ with the lost. Preaching is the way people hear the love of Christ. Now, are you sharing the love of Christ? How is the preaching of Christ crucified the power of God? When God knocks on the door of a person's heart through preaching and he or she accepts they are indeed a sinner in need of the saving blood of Jesus, the power of God Almighty cleanses them from their sins. Is this not a reason to share the good news? Dear Lord Jesus, Lord, make me bolder. Lord, may I share your word and the gospel message of your death and resurrection with someone who doesn't know you. Lord, help me to be your example to the lost. Help me to be a person who shares your love in all that I do by my words and actions. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, I'm going to get straight to this. I'm going to play the interview, and this should blow people's minds. I'm going to start this out in video, and if you're watching the stream, you can go to Paul Sutliff on Facebook and watch the stream. Or you can go to the Sutliffian Report on Facebook. I will have the interview up later today, hopefully later today, into YouTube. I'm just going to post the interview there. I will not post something else there. So here we go. All right. And I thought I had the... Forgive me on BTR. I'm going to pull this up pretty quick. The joy of thinking you had everything ready. The Sutliffian Report. I have Claire Lopez with me, the founder and president of Lopez Liberty, LLC, with a mission to educate Americans to national security threat from the Islamic movement.
the Muslim Brotherhood and its collaborators among the ranks of Marxist communists in this country. She is also a former career operations officer with the CIA and a senior analyst for Avena Associates, a strategic operations communications firm. From 2014 to 2020, Lopez served as vice president for the research analysis of the Center for Security Policy. She's been a senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research and a member of the board of advisors for the Canadian Mackenzie Institute. In 2016, she was named a Senator Ted Cruz's presidential campaign national security advisory team. Lopez provides her expertise as an instructor on Iran, Hezbollah, and the Red-Green Axis for Understanding the Threat, which is a national training program for federal, state, and local agencies, and the private sector on the global Islamic movement and jihadi networks. Claire, thank you for joining us. I want to say I'm amazed. When I read your affidavit, I thought I knew something. Your affidavit kind of blew my mind. It begins by summarizing who Hezbollah is. We know they are terrorists. We know that they are we're working we know that they are a terrorist group, jihadi group from Iran, working predominantly in Jordan of late. Can you tell us how Iran?
No, they're not from Iran, and they don't work in Jordan. They're Lebanese.
They're Lebanese. Okay, I'm sorry. Can you tell us how Hezbollah was involved with Al Qaeda?
Sure. So you are referring to a legal case called the Havlish case, for which I was an expert witness from the period of time 2009 until 2011. Just in a nutshell, that legal case pursued an investigation into the Iranian regime and Hezbollah involvement with al-Qaeda in the attacks of 9/11. In late December 2011, Judge George Daniels, who had the case, Southern District of New York, Manhattan, ruled from the bench that Iran and Hezbollah were co-responsible with al-Qaeda for the 9/11 attacks. You may read the case documents at Iran911case.com. The affidavit that I co-wrote with my friend and colleague, Dr. Bruce Teft, is exhibit number 6. That is the history of the Iran-Hezbollah-Al-Qaeda relationship. So, back to Hezbollah. After the 1979 revolution in Iran, the regime under Ayatollah Khomeini immediately turned to exporting the revolution. they tried in Iraq. By the way, that's why Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, because Iran was threatening to turn the 60% Shiite population of Iraq against Saddam Hussein and topple the government. That's why Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980. But let's go back to Hezbollah. So there were already familial links among the clerical families, Shiite all, of Iran and of Lebanon by marriage and other ties. And so Iran immediately began to establish a proxy jihad terror force in Lebanon. And by the early 1980s, that organization coalesced and became known as Hezbollah. By the way, pronounce it Hezbollah, because Hezb in Arabic means party, Allah means God. Party of God. If you don't pronounce it that way, you don't get the meaning. Hezbollah.
Thank you.
The new organization immediately began to turn to terrorist pursuits. Of course, we had the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Marine Corps barracks, our embassy, and also the French there. Fast forward to 1990. The war in Afghanistan to oust the Soviet Red Army is now over. The Red Army has fled Afghanistan. Those fighters that had come from other places began to drift back to their home countries. Well, Osama bin Laden, who, by the way, was never a fighter, He was a financier. He bought things like pickup trucks and financed housing for the jihadis going to and from. But he had attracted a network of followers, which was not yet Al-Qaeda, by the way, but around him. And he wanted to go back home to Saudi Arabia at a time when Saddam Hussein was threatening Saudi Arabia, and he offered the services of his fighters. But the Saudi government, the Saudi leadership is a little more savvy than that. They wanted no part of Osama bin Laden or his fighters. And they said, no, you're not coming back here. And so bin Laden, and ultimately also Ayman al-Zawahiri, then number two, now number one, if he still is around, found safe haven with the Muslim Brotherhood regime of Umar al-Bashir in Sudan, in Khartoum. They went there. And very shortly after, they all decided they should hold what I've taken to calling a jihad jamboree. And so they invited all the jihadis of the world to Khartoum, PLO, PFLP, Hezbollah, of course, and the top leadership of the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic of Iran. The president, Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, came to Khartoum. The intel chief, Ali Falahian, came to Khartoum. The head of the IRGC, Mohsen Rezai, came to Khartoum, where they all mixed and mingled and came to an agreement that they would align with one another, Shiites and Sunnis, against the infidel, that is, against us. I mean, to this day, our, you know, members of national security, you can hear them say, Shiites and Sunnis won't work together. Well, they totally missed this meeting, needless to say. They completely missed that it ever happened. Major, major development in the Islamic Jihad world. They completely missed it. This has a lot to do with their cluelessness before 9/11. And at that meeting in Khartoum, the Osama bin Laden turns to the Iranian president, Rafsanjani, and says, hey, I really like what your Hezbollah boys do with big building suicide truck bomb explosions. Can you teach my guys how to do that? And Rafsanjani says, yes, of course. Imad Mughniya, a name that I'm sure is familiar, or at least I hope it's familiar to everybody listening, the top terror chieftain of Hezbollah for decades, until he met his demise in February of 2008 in Damascus and went off to find out whether there really were 72 virgins, or maybe they were grapes. We're not sure, depending on the translation. And so Imad Mughniya set up training camps for the Al-Qaeda guys in Sudan, also in Lebanon, also in Iran, maybe other places too, and began training them how to do suicide big building bombings. And so what followed? Excuse me. What followed in 1996 was Khobar Towers. In 1998, the embassy, U.S. embassy bombings in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. In October of 2000, although not a truck vehicle, but a waterborne boat vehicle, suicide bombing against the USS Cole in port in Yemen. And then, of course, finally 9/11. Now, what I've just told you comes from my research 10, 12 years ago as an expert witness in the Havlisch case. Everything I just told you is completely open source, as is my affidavit, which is footnoted to a Fare Thee Well. You don't need classified information. You don't need little black boxes. All you need to do is, there's this thing, it's called the internet. Took a long time to write that together with Bruce Teft, but we finished. Submitted it to the judge, as I said, in May of 2011. He ruled in December, Iran and Hezbollah co-responsible with Al-Qaeda for the attacks of 9/11. Well, you would have expected this would be a bombshell. But no, the Obama administration at the time, and of course the obedient media, collaborated to squash the entire story. And one can speculate perhaps why. The Obama administration in 2011 had not yet begun the secret negotiations behind the scene with then Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman John Kerry, who in I think it's either late 2012, maybe early 2013, would begin those secret negotiations with the mullahs in Oman. But certainly by 2011, the Obama administration was thinking about all this and how they wanted to grovel and crawl on their hands and knees before the Iranian regime. And they certainly didn't want information like this stirring things up at a time like that. But I'll tell you what has set me back is that no president since then, to include Donald Trump and obviously whatever that is that's occupying the White House these days, has said a word. Even now at again the 20th year commemoration tomorrow of the 9/11 attacks, not a single word about the Iranian and Hezbollah involvement. And that really does set me back.
I had always thought that would be Iran might be involved in some way. And I'm kind of mind blown of the amount of information that was in that. It's not a long affidavit. It's 140 pages.
Something,
it's not long to read. And it is power packed with information that is, again, open source. One of the things that surprised me in there is you state in there, or you both state in there that the affidavit states that one branch of Al-Qaeda's core leadership had been in Iran since 2001. Could you explain a little bit more about that? And I'm just curious if that's true today.
Yes, it remains true to this day. So what happened after 9/11, of course, NATO rallied to the United States. We went in together to Afghanistan to oust Al-Qaeda, to oust the Taliban from power. That was accomplished rather rapidly in a matter of weeks. The battles of Tora Bora kind of finished it all, and Al-Qaeda split. Now, obviously, this was planned way, way, way ahead of time. They knew exactly what would happen after they hit the United States on the homeland. They knew that they would be invaded. They knew that they would lose power. And they had already at least a year to 2 years in advance planned their escape routes. So they split. One of the Shura Councils, as you would call it, went to the cities of Pakistan, in particular Quetta. That's Ayman al-Zawahiri in particular went there. Others went and hid out in the mountainous region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But the third bunch, the third, excuse me, the third Shura group, if you will, of Al-Qaeda went to Iran. Now, that escape route had been planned, as I said, way ahead of time. And one of the Taliban warlords, named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is coming back into the fore once again today. He'd been on the outs with the Taliban, and he had left Afghanistan in the 1990s and went to Iran, but it turned out to be very convenient because he was the liaison between the Taliban, between Al-Qaeda, and the Iranian regime, the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, and the intelligence services, and he helped prepare that escape route. How do we know this? We know this because a very prominent, well-respected British journalist, and maybe you remember better than I do, Paul, I think it might have been Con Coughlin, but if I'm mistaken about that, I apologize. But in any case, sure, a well-known and well-respected British journalist got an interview with bin Laden. And bin Laden told him the story of how they escaped into Iran. Now, here's the part that kind of galls, I think. Well, for me anyway. The U.S. government, that is the administration of President George W. Bush, the Saudis, Al-Qaeda, and Iran made an agreement among themselves that bin Laden and his fighters and families would be in Iran. Now, to put the most charitable spin on that, we might say, well, they thought bin Laden would be off the battlefield, or the combat, as it were, bottled up maybe, and not a threat as long as he was inside of Iran. Well, of course, that supposition, if such it was, fell apart rather quickly. Djerba, Tunisia come to mind. The train bombing in Madrid come to mind. That's all Al-Qaeda out of Iran that planned those. Never mind the Via Railway plot of 2013-14 that planned to bomb the passenger train service that runs between New York and Toronto, Canada, and they were going to blow it up at the point it crossed the bridge over the Niagara River Gorge. Now, luckily, happily, that plot was foiled. But all of these were plots coming out of the Al-Qaeda branch inside of Iran. By the way, it was called the Khorasan unit. If you wonder where that name comes from, go back in history to the ancient Persian Empire that stretched from today's Iran over what is today a border into Afghanistan. And that was Khorasan province. That's where the name comes from. By the way, I should mention quickly, one other escape route was used by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Remember that name?
Yeah.
He was at those final battles in Afghanistan, fled overland, and he fled through Iran, where it seems he may have gotten some medical treatment for injuries, and then he winds up in Iraq, in the Sulaymaniyah area, north of Baghdad, where Saddam Hussein just, you know, says, okay, you can stay there. Another reason why Saddam Hussein really needed to go. But that's another escape route that was planned years ahead of time, at least a couple years. So this is the story. This is the story of post 9/11 and how bin Laden and his family and fighters were inside of Iran late 2001 until about mid-2010 when they decamped and went to Abbottabad in Pakistan. And 1 year later, of course, U.S. Special Operations Forces took care of them. But a remnant of that Al-Qaeda unit still remains in Iran. I believe, not positive, but believe Saif al-Adel, the military commander, remains inside of Iran. Perhaps he's left by now, but he was there for a long time, even after bin Laden left. So this is the collaboration that you've got between Al-Qaeda and Iran.
It's shocking. It is incredibly shocking. One of the other things that you went into great detail on is how Iran provided support for Al-Qaeda. And as I read this, you know, I initially had thought it would be primarily financial assistance, but you're also talking about providing a safe haven, which I must have missed because maybe I was reading faster than I should have. But the other thing that you mentioned in there is travel assistance for the 9/11 hijackers. So if you could clarify some of that, please.
Right. So in late 2000 and into early 2001, Imad Mughniyeh, our Hezbollah terror chief, traveled to Saudi Arabia and went village to village down the Red Sea coast to recruit the 15 out of the 19 hijackers who eventually were Saudi. Now, that didn't happen without orders from Tehran, and also did not happen without at least acquiescence, if not collaborative coordination with the Saudi regime of the time. He recruited them, and then he escorted them on flights around the Middle East as they went about briefing and training Iran, Beirut, Afghanistan, and then oversaw their initial training inside of Iran. The Iranian intelligence services acquired jet plane passengers, 737, 757 plane simulators. They bought them out in East Asia, I think it was Malaysia, brought them back to Iran, and that is how the Saudi hijackers began their training inside of Iran. But back to Hezbollah, it was Imad Mughniya overseeing all of that training and escorting them when they needed to travel elsewhere. One quick note last on this subject. When those Saudis with their, they had brand new Saudi passports, by the way. I'm so sorry. Crossed Iranian borders, there was obviously an agreement reached, and this is another affidavit in the set written by Janice Kephart, another of our expert witnesses. There was some kind of an agreement reached between the governments of Iran and Saudi Arabia about some kind of mark. And to this day, we don't know what that mark was. It remains classified, but some kind of a mark inside those passports that alerted the border guards, who were instructed not to stamp their passports for travel inside of Iran, which is how those hijackers, the 15, could eventually go back to Saudi Arabia and get visas at whichever U.S. consulate it was in a clean passport. Now, personally, I think all kinds of red flags ought to have gone up when these guys appeared before the window, you know, stamps or no stamps, but that's me.
I have to say I agree with you. I was rereading the 9/11 Commission report, and yes, it's not like flags didn't pop up. It's we didn't have any concept of what dangers they could present, I think. I wanted to comment on one more thing here. On page 40, let me get this back here. There was a quote I wanted to read from your affidavit. It says on page 40, it was paragraph 102. It said, at nearly the last minute before publication, in the 9/11 Commission report in July of 2004, Commission staff member Lori Fenner discovered file cabinets full of thousands of hard copy documents at the Fort Meade headquarters of the National Security Agency, NSA. Fenner and fellow Commission staff member and CIA veteran Lloyd Salvetti reviewed them and found extensive files that referred to the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iran and between Osama bin Laden and the Iranian-backed terror group Hezbollah. I'm saying it correctly this time? I hope.
Sounds good.
All right. The late discovery on the eve of publication explains the brief description in the 9/11 Commission report of the material support provided to Al-Qaeda by Iran. The commission acknowledges the need for continued investigation by stating, we, the commissioners, believe this topic, Iranian involvement in 9/11, requires further investigation by the United States government, which follows with this. That was said on page 241 of the 9/11 Commission report. And following that up, the affidavit states, no such investigation has ever been undertaken by any branch of the U.S. government in the 5.5 years since. Now, that was, I mean, we're talking about it, when that affidavit was written and that commission report was done in 2004, Has anything been done to date?
Well, no, of course not. There is not a single person in senior U.S. leadership that has the knowledge, first of all, which I suspect the Donald Trump administration did not have. I suspect they simply were not told, did not know. But the others previous to him knew. They didn't want anything to do with holding Iran and Hezbollah to account for the attacks of 9/11. Why? Because they were too busy crawling on hands and knees and begging the mullahs, pretty please, won't you please talk to us so that we can come to a nuclear deal, which means nothing. And we know you're making, we know that you're already building warheads anyway, but we're gonna just ignore that part so we can have a nice little piece of paper here that nobody ever signed, by the way. Neither the U.S. government, the Iranian government, or any of the other parties of the P5 plus one, that means the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, nobody signed this thing. Oh, plus one is Germany. Nobody ever signed it. But they were intent upon getting that agreement. They didn't care that it was false. They didn't care that it meant nothing. They didn't care. Now, again, to give credit to President Trump, he absolutely took a much harder line against the Islamic regime of Iran than either of his two predecessors or the current occupant of the White House is doing, to his credit. But he didn't have enough time to complete what he had in mind to bring that regime to account. But I still say I don't think that President Trump ever knew about this legal case or obviously this affidavit. it remains to this day that no national security leader, and I mean, you know, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, National Security Advisor, not a one since 2011 when our report came out and the judge ruled in our favor. And also, by the way, since then imposed huge financial penalties against Iran, which will never be paid. But none of those senior figures has ever spoken a word about this. I don't know if they know or not. I doubt they would care if they did know, but they may not know.
That in itself is scary when I think about it, to say that the worst attack, terror attacks on American soil, that those who are in charge of national security are ignorant of the actors. And that's one of the statements I made during my show yesterday was, have we learned anything? And
pardon me.
I think that there are those of us who have, and those who remain in government, are they, my understanding when I was studying intelligence analysis as a graduate student, and I was learning the reason why we don't investigate the Islamic connection is George Bush's statement that Islam is not our enemy, and that that was a forbidden element now for the intelligence analysis to look in that. Is that still going on?
Oh, absolutely. It's still going on, worse than ever. It wasn't just President George W. Bush, but going back certainly to the Clinton administration of the 1990s, the Muslim Brotherhood infiltrated the United States government. Now, anybody who knew anything about the Muslim Brotherhood, John Guandolo, Robert Spencer, Coughlin, Bill Warner, Bill Gothrop, trainers of U.S. government analysts and others, briefers of senior Pentagon officials, Their knowledge, their information about the Brotherhood, about all of this, got them fired, essentially. Nobody wanted to talk about this. Nobody. And so by the time President Bush comes along, and your listeners, your viewers, Paul, might recall, I think, a pretty well publicized photo of President Bush at the great big Islamic mosque of Northwest Washington, D.C., where he intones Islam is a religion of peace. This is barely days after 9/11. He is surrounded in the photo, and most people may not recognize who those people are, but he is completely surrounded all around him by Brotherhood.
Yes,
Three inches off his left shoulder is Nihad Awad. Nihad Awad is, to this day, the executive director of CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, which is the Hamas branch in the United States. He hadn't a chance. Bush didn't have a chance. He was completely surrounded and co-opted by the Brotherhood. No information that I've shared with you today would ever, ever have been allowed to reach the Oval Office of George W. Bush. Now, the Obama administration, of course, knows plenty of this, but they were batting for the other team. And I think, as I've said, that the Trump administration very likely was never briefed on any of this. I think they probably do not know about this. And in particular, because the Havlish case, the judge's ruling, our affidavits, all of that was squashed. It was completely deep-sixed by the media as well as by successive senior administration officials.
Mind-numbing. It's totally mind-numbing. Claire, I want to say thank you for joining us. Please tell everyone how they can continue to follow your work and help support your continual patriotism. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, I do not have a website yet. It's in the works. It's coming. But for the moment, you may find videos like this one, my writing, at places like the United West, Citizens Commission on National Security, which is the successor group to Citizens Commission on Benghazi, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and writing at Front Page Magazine, also videos with Jamie Glazoff at the Glazoff Gang. And very important, at American Truth Project with Barry Nussbaum. I just did a long-form interview with him yesterday. American Truth Project. And if you would like to receive text messages, alerts about my interviews with Barry and with American Truth Project, you may enter my last name, Lopez, all caps, L-O-P-E-Z. Enter that in your cell phone. Text to 88202, and you will get notification. Promise we won't overwhelm you, bombard you. Every other week or so, something like that, to notify you of my American Truth Project videos and interviews. So those are the main places right now where you can find my work.
Thank you, Claire. God bless you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Paul, very much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, one of the things that hit me about this interview, as I still sit there and listen to it, is did we learn anything from 9/11's 2001 attack? Did we learn anything? The 9/11 attack on U.S. soil, did we learn? Well, let's see what we learned. We learned a little bit more about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda had already attacked us, remember. They had attacked the USS Cole. They had done several other attacks. Did we learn anything? Let's keep asking that question.
we learned how to make war in a desert. Did we learn about the enemy that attacked us? That's the real question. Now, as you listen to Claire's interview, did you catch how President Bush in September of 2001 was surrounded by members of the Muslim Brotherhood? He was clueless then about the enemy, and sadly has demonstrated he is even more clueless lately. President Obama claimed on WhiteHouse.gov when he was president that the Muslim Brotherhood are a nonviolent group. Really? Is that why they attack police stations and the military in Egypt? Is that why they got condemned for doing assassinations? Is that why Hamas, I'm asking, is that if they're really nonviolent, why do they have Hamas, a chapter of the Muslim Brotherhood, sending thousands of rockets into Israel? Really, they're nonviolent. Sounds like Obama was lying to us on purpose. Well, that's not unusual, unfortunately. Is that why their members are literally in every Islamic terrorist entity in the world, including Al-Qaeda? These are important questions. Unfortunately, they're not being asked. Not by the people that should be asking the questions. That bothers me most of all. Let's keep going. Believe it or not, this week, Memory.org caught and translated Egyptian TV host Ibrahim Issa on Al-Qahira Wal Nas TV's very important statement on this topic. Now, for those of you watching the stream session, you'll be able to read the translation. I'm going to read the translation to those listening on BTR, so it'll probably be just a little delayed. I apologize. So let me play this. Now, this has to do with the recent planned fiasco in Afghanistan. But again, if the real enemy is Islam, when you hear the term Islamist put in here, I want you to think about that. Islamist is a made-up word. It's all about Islam, people. It implies that there is no such thing. So reason why I want to play this is it kind of shows something that most people can't conceive of. Let me see if I can get this ready here. I don't know if I've got to double check and see if I put this into BTR, which is even worse. So let me get that up. Hold on just a second here. I can get this ready for BTR. And I'm just going to read the screen when I play this for BTR, because I don't, yeah, it's all said in another language. So that's the part I think is you know, sad. I'm just going to read what's said on the screen. All right. Okay. And we're just listening to the memory music. Again, this is Egyptian TV host Ibrahim Issa. Came out September 1st. Why do people say that terrorism has no religion? So what is terrorism then? When a terrorist says that he wants to implement the true religion as was given to us by Allah, he said, and that he wants to implement the Sharia, you want to tell me that it has nothing to do with religion? Everybody is saying, look at any act of terrorism in the world, a man running over people in Europe, a bombing in Sinai, a bombing in Afghanistan. Everybody immediately says terrorism has no religion. And they say it in the utmost devotion and acceptance. What do you mean by terrorism has no religion? Come on. He continues, what is it then? He is using religion, using hadith and Quranic verses. So we must respond to the fact that he is saying that this is the religion. He continues, terrorism does have a religion. Sometimes it is a Muslim terrorist and his religion is Islam. Other times it's a right-wing Christian terrorist, he says. So how come terrorism has a religion? My point is that the Muslim Brotherhood, he continues, were and still are same as the Taliban, but with a different name. If the Muslim Brotherhood were given the opportunity, the Muslim Brotherhood Supreme Guide Muhammad Badi was in Afghanistan right now, he would have made the people dress the same way in Afghanistan and would have done everything in his power to implement the Sharia. It's not the Taliban is narrow-minded.
And the Muslim Brotherhood is more open-minded. Not at all. It's only a matter of environment, feasibility, and opportunity. Once they have the opportunity, they will all be like the Taliban. The important point here is the desire of some elements in the Islamic movement to improve the image of the Taliban. We are mainly talking about Turkey and Qatar. The desire to peddle this new version of Taliban, this is nonsense altogether. It's an attempt to present the, quote, new version of the Taliban. This is the new age Mullah Omar died. The mullah that followed him was killed by the Americans. This is all an illusion. The Taliban is the same old Taliban. If the Taliban ever changed, it would stop being called Taliban. This is its raison d'etre. In addition, they are nice enough to say clearly, enough of this democracy nonsense already. They are simply saying this. They are not wasting time on saying that they have changed or trying to embellish their image. The Taliban is the essence and the culmination of all the Islamic ideas. Now, think about that. I want you to think about that. This is a man on Egyptian TV saying this in an Islamic country. Think about it. It's kind of mind-numbing. It's hard to accept sometimes that that is the real truth. Now, did you catch this? The reason why, I don't know if you know that today is one of my, I'm not sure if it was the beginning of September or this week. I think it's pretty close to this week being the fifth anniversary of my broadcast. The show has changed from Civilization Jihad Awareness to the Sutlifian Report. Changed this week. Now, I've been doing this now for 5 years, and I have not changed my message that Islam is the real danger that we are fighting. It is our enemy. It is still the enemy that attacked us on 9/11. But, again, BTR, the great people on Global Patriot Radio, let me continue here. BTR is not naming who the enemy is. The government is not naming who the enemy is. Why? Because the enemy isn't Sunni or Shiite alone. It's both. You know, we learned that from listening to Claire. Her evidence of providing this information, this is just kind of mind-numbing when you start to think about it. It is Islam. This week, Todd Benson pointed out that the 9/11 Commission report did indeed capture who exactly was our enemy in his article for the Investigative Project on Terrorism, Selective Memory, the carefully excised why of the 9/11 attacks. American media won't speak its name. Investigative Project on Terrorism substitute Islamists for Islamic. And I'll get into that. But here we go. Let me just read this part of this article. Todd writes, quote, "But the enemy is not just terrorism, some generic evil. The vagueness blurs the strategy. The catastrophic threat at this moment in history is more specific. It is the threat posed by Islamic terrorism, especially the Al-Qaeda network, its affiliates, and its ideology." Now, that comes from the 9/11 Commission Report, page 360T. Now, I substitute the word Islamic. And for Islamist, because Islamist is a made-up word to imply that Islam separates from politics. Never happens. Never happens. And I'm just noticing that my image has missed the screen. Okay. All right. In the American media's impressive production output of 20th anniversary, 9/11, retrospectives this past week, a grand commission is now glaring. Why? The hijackers and Al-Qaeda did it. The short answer is they did it out of religious conviction to their interpretation of Islam. No, it's not their interpretation of Islam. That's the one place where I'll say, Todd, you're wrong. It is Islam. Case in point for selective media amnesia can be found in a story based on the Flight 93 recovered cockpit recordings. It reconstructed heart-rending recollections of conversations between loved ones on the ground and the 40 bravely insurgent passengers, largely omitted in commemoration coverage, was any reminder that the same recordings offered a glimpse into the hijacker's state of mind at an authentic moment of truth.
9 times over that flight's final 6 seconds before it nosedived into a Shanksville, Pennsylvania field from 10:03 in 2 seconds to 10:03 in 9 seconds. He chanted, "Allah is the greatest." Allah Akbar was saying. Allah Akbar. He said it 9 times. One by the only by the most acrobatic, Todd writes, of intellectual yoga did major U.S. media dodge civic obligation to remember and explore the religious motive that drove the 9/11 hijackers to mass murder. Media outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, and the majority of major city newspapers and online outlets mostly danced lightly past their duty to remind a younger generation that thousands of Islamic fanatics at home and around the world harbor the very same religious ideology and still endeavor to kill them the next time. Highly nimble USA Today, for example, pretzel twisted itself under and over and then around having to mention the motivating religious animus by posting a story with the subhead, 8 influential Muslim Americans discuss how 9/11 and Islamophobia affected life in the U.S. over 2 decades. CBS News engaged in similar misdirection with a piece titled "Muslim Americans Still Face Hostility 20 Years After 9/11. A CNN story containing no evidence leads viewers anywhere else possible with the headline, "Too Many Muslim Children Dread 9/11 Every Year." Stories of anti-Islamic hate crimes, when they are true, deserve to be told, of course. But the dereliction of duty to complete the more complicated, accurate portrait in which 9/11's perpetrators acted out their perceived religious duty shortcuts the opportunity to explain how that same motivation has survived and thrived. Think about this. People, we need to think about this. This is crazy. It survived and thrived. Todd continues, fortunately, the 567-page 9/11 Commission Report, I have a copy. I read part of it last week. The 9/11 Commission Report, U.S. government's three-year-long bipartisan investigative effort to provide a full as possible historic account of how the attack succeeded and why the perpetrators carried them out, well, the why, I'm going to say, is very much missing. The why is very much missing, unfortunately. Exists for moments like these. The report was authored by the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. That was an independent bipartisan group created on November 27, 2002 by an act of Congress signed by the President George W. Bush to study and then hold hearings about what happened. I submit to you that Todd Spendman is right in every aspect with the exception of the one thing he did so this could be put in print. Now, he exchanged the word Islamic for Islamist, which he said, whatever you heard me say that word Islamic, he had actually written Islamist. That word Islamist implies, again, as I said before, that somewhere on earth exists an Islam without politics. Sorry, that's imaginary. It's not truth-telling. And that's one of the reasons why I will not tell that story. Todd Benzman is doing what he can to get the truth out. But even good men like him and Stephen Emerson's investigative project on terrorism is being forced to slightly mislead us by using the term Islamist. I have problems with that. I've had this discussion before when I was thinking about using the term Islamist. I've used Islamist before as myself to get things out. And I thought that would paint a more truthful message. And you know what? I had a discussion with people who were upset with my usage of that word. And you know, I have to turn around and say they were correct. This is really not naming the enemy. It's allowing them to win where they're not telling the truth. And this is what I'm talking about. So you want proof what I'm saying is correct. Let's listen to the words of Islamic scholars in the West on the terms of jihad and you know, things like that. When they think they're only talking to Muslims. This week, believe it or not, this past, well, not even kids. This one happened in August 27th. In the U.S. Capitol, yes, Washington, D.C., by a Shiite imam, Dr. Sulaiman Ali Hassan, on August 27th, not even 30 days ago. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to put this in the stream, and then I'm going to play this here. This one, my question is, when you hear this, what do you think? These are the Shiites. This is what the Shiites are saying.
Islam has emphasized that we should all be mujahid. When the time calls for one type of sacrifice, we should be ready for that type of sacrifice. If Islam is under attack, then we should make sure that all of us are preparing and readying ourselves to be able to defend Islam in the way that it is being attacked. If there is a physical attack, then we should all be ready with martial training and self-defense training so that we can stand up for our rights and our dignity. If it is an intellectual attack, then all of us should be armed with the weapons of intellect and reasoning. Inshallah, may Allah allow all of us to enter into paradise through the gates of jihad. Jihad can be through funding, and jihad can be through struggling in person. Both of them are needed, and both of them are important. If somebody who is al-ghazi, who is doing jihad in particular on the battlefield, and so you should consider their sacrifice and their struggle to be something that is important to you, and pray for them, and try to make their life easier by helping their family, by helping those dependents of theirs who may not have their father or their husband or their person present for them. So according to hadith, jihad is one of those things that brings a special grace of Allah and mercy of Allah and fulfillment of prayer. This hadith is particular to those who are in a military battle for defense of Islam, but that principle applies in general to all forms of jihad.
Just waiting for the
May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us among al-mujahideen fi sabilillah bil-amwal
wal-amwal,
with our possessions and with ourselves.
Now, again, this last part, I have to say, I want you to think about that. That was in D.C. That was on August 27th. Now, I have been working with some friends in Canada, and they've made me very aware of some of the Canadian imams up there, what they are saying. And I sit there kind of amazed that some of these things are allowed to be said in public. And just as I'm kind of shocked as what was said in D.C., in a Washington, D.C. mosque, just as equally shocked at what was said at the Muslim Youth of Victorian Islamic Center. Now, I will say this, which I wasn't going to, and I will. Islamic Center, whenever you see those two words, chances are they are owned and run by the Muslim Brotherhood. I want you to think about that. Whenever you see that, please start paying attention to those mosques in your community. Are they run by the Muslim Brotherhood? Now, I'm going to play what Yunus Kathrada stated to youth, to teenagers in Canada. This
again, if it doesn't shock you, something is wrong. We need to start being concerned about these things. Why? Why should we be concerned? Well, think about, he says more than what we would expect. He doesn't talk just about, talks about several different things, but this is his opinion, and he's a Sunni. So are the Sunnis and the Shiites agreeing? Almost on everything, people. Wait till you hear this. Okay.
They're willing to spend mountains of gold in order to take us away from al-Islam. So they will spend it. But don't fear. At the end of the day, they're not going to win. Allahu Jalla wa Ala tells us, so they will spend it. Then it will be for them a source of regret. 20 years in Afghanistan. I don't need to say anymore. A source of regret. Then they will be overcome. Does this sound familiar to you? Have you been listening to the news? Naqulu Allahu Akbar. They will attack what is most sacred to us. But all of that they do is only a small portion of what is really in their hearts, of the hatred that they have towards us in their hearts. Do not think that the Jews and the Christians are our friends. They are our enemies. I incite you to show support for your brothers in Afghanistan who want to establish the Sharia in their land. We see that the West wants to talk about the rights of women. The rights of women. Ah, yes. Her right to be a prostitute. Her right to sleep around with whomever she wishes. I want you to understand what those rights are, by the way. Her rights to be abused. Her right to show her body off to men who get off on watching her in porn and in other than that. Allahumma ansur al-mujahideen fi sabilika fi kulli makan. اللهم وفق إخواننا في أفغانستان أن يقيموا شرعك على هذه الأرض.
All right, and I want to say this is shocking, shocking, shocking stuff. It should be. Again, that was said by Yunus Kathadra, an imam, a Sunni imam, at the Victoria Islamic Center. Now, this last part was said in Arabic, and it was done on purpose. God forbid somebody actually knew what he said to the teenagers, right? This is what Yunus said to the Canadian youth at the Victorian Islamic Center in Arabic. Allah grant victory to the mujahideen fighting for your sake everywhere. Allah grant success to our brothers in Afghanistan so that they establish your Sharia in the land. Does that shock anyone? The question should be, if it doesn't, why doesn't it? Now, I could play tapes like this all night. Islam, not Islamists, were the enemy attacking the United States. It has been, I mean, it has been this way. People don't understand, and I'm sorry you don't, that this is the thing we need to think about. They have been attacking us for a while. Again, it was a combination of the followers of Islam. It was not just Sunnis. It was Shiites as well. It wasn't just Al-Qaeda. It was governments as well. The only thing that they had together was Islam. People, wake up. Start doing your own research. You'll find out what I'm sharing is actually true and scarily true. Claire Lopez will tell you this. There are so many great men and women, I'll tell you this, and it just saddens me to think that some people don't get it. Now, let's talk about this week. This week is what I call a horrorversary. What is a horrorversary? I don't like the term anniversary when I think of tragedies like 9/11. We're not celebrating. We are mourning. And for those of us who are not in our young 20s, those of us who are older and remember where we were on 9/11, well, all we can think of is the horror that we experienced that day. And I still cry when I read that 9/11 report, as I did last week. So I want you to think about this. Is it Islam? Is Islam the enemy? Now, Robert Spencer caught something this week. This should be news. It should be on every TV station in the United States. But no. No, you have to protect the image that Islam is peaceful. Well, let me tell you what happened at Washington University. Robert Spencer wrote this in PJ Media. The title is Muslim Student at Washington University Removes 2,977 American Flags Commemorating 9/11 Victims. Fidel Alkani, a student at Washington University in St. Louis, is an enterprising young man who clearly has a bright future ahead. On Saturday, as people all over the world mourn the deaths of 2,977 people in jihad attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., and, of course, we have to count Pennsylvania, Alkani busied himself with pulling up 2,977 flags that had been placed on campus in honor of the victims and throwing them away. Among leftists today, that's the kind of behavior that leads to rapid career advancement. Clearly, Fidel Alkani is an up-and-coming young man to the leftists. What are we talking about when we say leftists? We're talking about commies. The flags were part of the Young America's Foundation's 9/11 Never Forget Project. The Young America Foundation activists at high schools and colleges across the country are keeping alive the memory of those lost to radical Islamic terrorists in the world-changing events of September 11, 2001. The iconic displays made up of 2,977 American flags, one for each innocent life taken, bring schools, communities, and individuals together to pay tribute and continue our promise to never forget. YAF members at the Washington University duly placed 2,977 flags to have, only to have Alkani, wearing a mask and his hair in a bun, come pluck up the flags and fill trash bags with them. In a video YAF posted on Twitter, Nathaniel Hope of Washington University's hardy band of college Republicans confronts Alkani, who justified his actions by claiming falsely play was a violation of school rules. He maintained that he, on the other hand, had not violated any university rules, telling Hope, "I did not violate any university legal policy. Now go away." Later Alkani posted online a formal statement of the flag relocation incident, in which he sanctimoniously employed the tried and true strategy of the communists everywhere. Yes, those are the leftists. He claimed victimhood instead of apologizing for his callous, thuggish, and fascist act. Alkani wrote, "Currently, there is a massive harassment campaign propagated primarily by Washington University College Republicans, as well as the National Young Americans Foundation, regarding an incident that occurred approximately at 6 a.m. Saturday, September 11, 2021. There is a large amount of misinformation circulating, and I seek to explain both what occurred and why it happened." The misinformation that he proceeds to clear up is the claim that he was stealing the flags. This is due to a Washington University College Republican member taking a video of him collecting flags in plastic bags. However, he states he had no intention of removing the flags from the mud field area, and his protest did not have the chance to be actualized. No, his planned protest was to place the bag of flags on mud field, along with various statistics. So why didn't he do it? Why did he steal the flags? Is theft not a crime? Did he own any of those flags? Did he own any of them? No. And he states he didn't violate any university code of conduct policy. Actually, the video quite clearly shows him pulling up the flags, which did indeed deface and destroy Young American YF's memorial and constitutes stealing the flags in itself. That Al-Khalani considers his actions justified, you see, because Muslims are victims. Since 9/11, Islamophobic hate crimes have been higher than everywhere before. Al-Khalani goes on to accuse the United States of various atrocities in response to 9/11, and then claims any memorial of 9/11 that does not contend with these facts is only incomplete. Were there really crimes, a lot of crimes against Muslims afterwards? No, there wasn't. You can see from this why Fidel Al-Khalani is a rising star with the communists and the Muslims around the United States, why we will almost certainly be hearing from him again. This is just the sort of half-truth and misinformation that this Washington University professors likely taught him, and that the commie marinate in these days to further cement his future as a congressman or senator. Commissar Al-Khalani, he piled on more victimhood propaganda and said, Muslims such as I have faced fear, harassment, and Islamophobia from those who unjustly use the victims of 9/11 as a political cudgel. Really? Robert Spencer writes, in reality, anti-Jewish hate crimes are far more common in the United States than anti-Muslim hate crimes. No hate crime is justified. Contention that Muslims in the United States have been unique victims of discrimination and harassment since 9/11 is simply not borne out by the facts. Al-Khalani lives in the commie left's fantasy world where MAGA hat-wearing yahoos roam the street unchallenged, threatening and brutalizing, quote, brown people, quote, at will. But don't worry, Al-Khalani's okay. For those of you who have been reaching out of concern for my safety, he says, I would like to assure you that I am working with the university to ensure that I am safe. I want you to think about that. He's getting the university's help to be safe while abusing the rights of others. If he's right and he really was getting help from the university to be safe, what does that say? Once you start to think about some of these things, it should just blow your mind. I don't know. I mean, I sit here and I think about some of these things and they hit me. I'm going about some that is still related to communism. I'm talking about President Biden. Yes, this past week, President Biden, as Claire would put it, the man occupying the White House, purposely declared war on 80 million to 100 million, depending on whichever stat is correct, of those who were not vaccinated. Now, again. This is the man I consider the commissar, Joe Dementia. I don't consider him the guy who's really serving as the president. I tend to believe it is Obama, but again, I can't prove that. But let's go a little bit back farther on talking about that war that he's declared. For the last 3 weeks before I did this show, actually it's 4 weeks now, so this will be week five, come to think of it. I had been saying that this was a planned, this Afghanistan withdrawal was a planned fiasco. What do I mean? I have been saying for the past 5 weeks that what happened in Afghanistan was planned. It was a planned fiasco for the purpose of bringing 100,000 Muslims here. Now, am I right? That's what we should be asking ourselves today. Was Sutliff right when he said this 5 weeks ago, when he said it 4 weeks ago, when he said it 3 weeks ago, last week? Is there evidence to suggest I may be right? Let's find out. This week, again, Robert Spencer, he wrote an article in, again, in PJ Media. Now, this one should shock you. Americans turned away from Virginia hospitals because of influx of Afghan evacuees. Yeah, you heard that right. Wow. Old Joe Biden's handlers are bringing 94,000 Afghan evacuees into the United States at the cost. Okay, so I was off by 6,000. So my original estimate of 100,000 that came from Biden's general stating they had removed 100,000 Afghans. So if there's only 94,000, okay, that's still closer to what he wanted, right? Old Joe Biden's handlers are bringing 94,000 into the United States, Spencer writes, at the cost of $6.4 billion in your money. That's how much it costs to bring them here. That's it, only to bring them here. The overall cost, however, may end up being much higher indeed. And even the establishment media's most committed far-left propaganda organs are noticing. The Washington Post reported Tuesday that the mass arrival of Afghan evacuees last month, many in need of medical care, wreaked havoc on North Virginia's hospital system, prompting a regional emergency response group to assume oversight after one hospital became overwhelmed with patients and federal officials lost track of where some Afghans were hospitalized. Lost track of? Are you saying you don't know where they are? Wait a minute. Have they even been past a security screening? That's what we need to be asking, if they're losing track of them already. The answer is no. It takes at least 3 years, people, screening, a thorough screening. It's not going to happen. That's before they're supposed to come here. That's not what happened. Spencer continues. This has involved denial of care to Americans. A hospital near the Dulles Expo Center that federal officials designated as the go-to spot for medical treatment began running out of available beds, forcing the hospital to turn away non-Afghan patients who weren't in need of critical care, said Nickerson, who also directs the Northern Virginia Hospital Alliance, and declined to name the hospital. Here in a nutshell, is the America Last policy of Biden's handlers. America's infrastructure is crumbling. There are many people in need right here. Working Americans are laboring under a heavy tax burden that is already crushing and it is about to get worse. And all this is going on, migrants are given priority over Americans for medical care. And the American taxpayer is expected to foot the bill. Area leaders have been asking the Biden administration to pay for the mounting cost of keeping track of the hospitalized evacuees and for giving them rides back to the Dulles Expo Center, where they have been temporarily housed. After a federal contractor took hours to retrieve some of the evacuees who were ready to be discharged, in that sentence, Biden administration means hardworking Americans who have jobs and work hard to support their families while also paying for the resettlement and health care of Afghan evacuees, among whom is a notable amount of jihadis. Kristen Nickerson, executive director of the Northern Virginia Emergency Response System, said, quote, our hospitals are already almost at capacity. It's not like they have tons of free available beds. We are still in the middle of a pandemic. Oh, yeah, that's right. The pandemic for which Biden's handlers are mandating vaccinations, except for migrants crossing the southern border. Will the Afghan evacuees have to get the vaccine, which truthfully is gene therapy, while they're in hospitals for their free taxpayer-funded health care? No answer. I want you to think about that. They didn't answer that one. Nickerson added, we normally wouldn't be part of a refugee response effort, but in this case, of course, nothing was planned in advance. General Mark Miley's thorough modern military was far too busy implementing critical race theory and rooting Trump supporters out of ranks all summer to concern itself with formulating a coherent plan for withdrawing from Afghanistan. Again, I state over and over again that this was a planned fiasco. It wasn't a bungle. It was planned. I want you to think about this. What happens when American citizens come last? When the citizens of a country that they reside in, a citizens of a country legal rights to vote, come last. Again, some of these things are just too mind-blowing to accept. Now, President Biden and Bush and Obama have called Islam a religion of peace. None of them ask why the followers of Islam yell Allah Akbar when attacking. Not one of them asked that. You would think this 20th horrorversary of 9/11 should have been a moment for peace. You think it was? Let's take a look in Italy. Was it peaceful in Italy? Was it? And the answer, sadly, is no. Let me share what happened in Italy on 9/11. I'm only talking about 9/11. This is sad. Truly, truly a sad event. On September 11th, this comes from the Prima Donna Agenel. I don't think I'm even close to saying Il Prima Tona Zionel. I can't pronounce it. I'm sorry. Fear and madness in Rimini, where a Somali immigrant, Muslim immigrant, stabbed five people, including a six-year-old child, who now hospitalized urgently, is dying. This crime took place on September 11th on the bus line 11 of the city of Ramagna, and more precisely in the Miramare district. The two controllers, two women, approached the Somali Muslim citizen to ask him to pay for a ticket. In response, the immigrant draws a knife, injures both women in the middle of the bus with terrified passengers sounding alarm. The man runs away on the streets, begins to slash anyone who comes within range. Among these are a six-year-old child whose jugular was severed by the immigrant. Ambulance has arrived at the scene. The two controllers, as reported, are immediately taken to the hospital in Cessna. One of the two women wounded in the neck is in bad shape. Meanwhile, the Somali immigrant, Muslim immigrant, fleeing through the streets of Rimini, tried to steal a car from two motorists, but his attempts failed. For the police, meanwhile, the man's chase has gone off, thanks to indicators for the witnesses. This is just mind numbing people. Was 9/11 peaceful with Muslims? And it gets worse. In Somalia, was it peaceful? No. Al-Shabaab is suspected in the murder of a local lawmaker. In Afghanistan, was it peaceful on 9/11? Well, a former soldier is beheaded to shouts of Allah Akbar there. In Iraq, was it peaceful? A town mayor was among four murdered by jihadis there. Nigeria, was it peaceful? Well, a Muslim militants are now suspected of hacking a pastor to death with machetes. Jihad seems forever in these people's minds. What about France? Well, let's see. On 9/11, was it peaceful in France? Well, the Daily Caller has a story on this one. There were deaths of 100. This is about an event that happened in 2015. So was it peaceful? The answer was not really. See, they are going through a trial right now there where the deaths of 130 people was nothing personal, stated a top suspect in the 2015 Paris terrorist attack. Now, this comes, again, from the Daily Caller. It came out September 15th in an article by Varun Hukari. Top suspect in November 2015 Paris terrorist attack said during a courtroom trial Wednesday, that's yesterday, people, that the deaths of 130 people were killed in the attacks was nothing personal. Salah Abdeslam was one of 14 defendants to speak at Wednesday's trial. The Associated Press reported. He is the only survivor of the terrorist cell that carried out the attacks and fled the city after abandoning his rental car and suicide vest. The two people who helped him travel to Paris from Brussels are also among the 20 men on trial for the attacks. Nine gunmen, suicide bombers associated with the Islamic State network, struck at several locations around Paris on November 13, 2015. Nothing personal. Was it an act of jihad, people? Is anybody asking that? Was it part of what Islam teaches? Was anybody asking that? No. Why? Because to ask that would be dangerous. Oh, it might help us find out who the enemy is. Oh, so we can't have that. What about Germany? Was Germany peaceful on 9/11? Well, it comes from medforth.biz. Terror alert in front of synagogue in Germany. Syrian allegedly plans explosive attack. This article came out today. After the terror alarm in front of synagogue in Hagen, Germany, on Wednesday evening, four arrests were made today. Again, this came out today. Among those arrested is a Syrian, age 16, a Muslim, who, according to a report in the news magazine, Der Spiegel, is said to have prepared a bomb attack on the synagogue. According to the news magazine, the police searched the flat of the youth and his father in the morning. On September 15th and 16th, Jews celebrate their highest holiday, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. This holiday is once again overshadowed by terror in Hagen. On Wednesday evening, following reports of a possible dangerous situation, the police conducted a large-scale operation in the German city, which had already become conspicuous by anti-Semitic activities in May. Now there have been arrests. The Hagen police stated on Twitter on Thursday morning, the criminal investigation led to the identification and arrest of a 16-year-old Hagen man. In the course of the investigation, a total of four arrests have been made. At the same time, initial searches are being carried out in properties of Hagen, and necessary further search measures will follow. This man was planning on killing a lot more people. Has it been peaceful? No. What's the one thing uniting all of these attacks? Islam. Now, I want to get back to this treasonous act of Joe Biden. I know I initially talked about it. This is the part I was
planning to get to. Joe Biden's act of treason this past week, he declared a war on those who have chosen not to take the gene therapy. That is proven not to protect them from COVID-19. In fact, if you go and get this shot, you will be told it will not protect you from COVID as you go to get the shot. So why do you call it a vaccine? Why? And if the vaccine doesn't protect, if vaccine's supposed to protect you, why are you asking those who are not vaccinated to get a vaccine so they can protect the vaccinated? Well, it's because it does nothing. Really? What's its real purpose? Now, I have a lot of statements on this. This is probably me more than anyone else. I don't know. But I listened to J.P. Sears on this. Now, J.P., I'm going to suggest everybody go to YouTube and subscribe to J.P. Awakens. I have to share this particular video he did. I found this incredibly truthful. Here we go. Just gonna start it off and try to get back to where mine is on.
The clear. Look, there's a very destructive, highly infectious variant of a terrible disease going around. It ruins lives, it's destroying society, and even causing some deaths. It's called the tyrant variant. This variant attacks people, leaving some crippled in fear with their brains incapable of thinking for themselves. How does the tyrant variant get transmitted? Well, it begins by attempting to infect the brain via a process called Marxism, inducing a state of delusional psychosis whereby the patient no longer believes in objective reality. They start to believe that women who give birth are no longer mothers and that men can have babies and that it's anti-racist to judge people based on their skin color. From there, the variant is in complete control of the host, without the host even knowing it. This variant even wants to convince you that you are dangerous until proven otherwise, so you need to be protected from yourself. And it tries to convince you that you are sick until proven healthy. You see, this variant attempts to camouflage itself by calling you what it is, sick and dangerous. And it relies on deception in order to take you over, trying to convince you not just that it's harmless, but it's helpful. Just like the scorpion that convinces the frog to trust it. And once the frog is inevitably stung, it asks, "Why did you sting me?" To which the scorpion replies, "That's what I do. After all, I'm a scorpion." As it is with a helpful, deceptive hand of the tyrant variant. What about immunity? Well, because people are pack animals, human connection is what creates herd immunity from the variant. Because just like a hyena, it can only take down a lion when it's isolated from the herd. So the tyrant variant tries to convince you that human connection is dangerous, because it is for the variant. The tyrant variant is also a threat to our national security, as it perfectly fits the definition of a domestic terrorist. The tyrant variant isn't an infectious disease created in a lab, though it's been known to create infectious diseases in a lab. Now, surprisingly, this variant is weak enough that it's not able to actually harm a person on its own. Its success of hurting people relies on getting people to be compliant with it, whereby obedience triggers an autoimmune reaction which causes people to hurt themselves through fear, conflict, and surrendering their freedoms. But here's what you want to know. Bravery and freedom have proven to be very effective treatments at quickly eradicating this variant from a person's life. Yet because these treatments aren't patentable, and therefore not very profitable, pharmaceutical companies with criminal records don't advocate the use of them. To protect yourself from the tyrant variant, please cover your eyes and ears anytime you're around a television, and turn it off as soon as possible. Then please sanitize your mind with your own thoughts and your own perceived reality. And inoculating yourself with a lot of human connection is very important, as this variant relies on social isolation in order to spread. So please do your part and get a booster of Hug several times a day to boost your immunity against it. And unlike the cold or flu, this variant isn't going to be around forever. It's not just something that we have to learn to live with, because this variant contains no power other than the power you give it. Just like the dog doesn't need the tick needs the dog. And you can remove this blood-sucking variant from your life anytime. How? You reclaim your power anytime you stand in bravery, freedom, and love, while no longer complying with this disease. If we all do our part, we have a bright, happy, healthy future ahead of us. God bless. One more thing, my friend.
So, I want you to think about that. It's time to stand up, people. It's time to stand up. Now, I want to talk more about the silliness of these mandates and the problems it's causing. Which kind of surprised me that even CBS News, who I distrust wholly, but I was surprised CBS News got a story correct. This week, CBS reported that an upstate New York hospital will stop delivering babies later this month, in part because employees have quit over a requirement that they be vaccinated against COVID-19. Six maternity staff members resigned from the Lewis County General Hospital last week, worsening an existing staff shortage, the Watertown Daily Times reported. The department has seven other unvaccinated employees who would also could decide to leave, the hospital officials said. The number of resignations received leaves us no choice but to pause delivering babies at Lewis County General Hospital, hospital CEO Gerald Kier said at a news conference Friday. He said, "It is my hope the State Department of Health will work with us in pausing the service rather than closing the maternity department." I posted this on LinkedIn, and one of the responses was, "Okay, what are we going to do with the women? Are you supposed to put a plug in that? How do you stop that?" And you find another hospital or one that's not going to require their employees to be vaccinated. Well, you know, if you listen to Joe Biden's declared war on American citizens, you find out that his mandate is causing problems. It's not just in New York State this insanity is going on. Believe it or not, it's happening in Texas. Now, Epic Times caught this one. I sat there and I caught this one, and you know, I sit there kind of like, whoa. It's kind of hilarious when I think about it. A Texas hospital is now facing closure over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. I want you to think about this. The chief executive of a hospital, this is by Jack Phillips, the chief executive of a hospital in Texas warned that his facility faces closure after President Joe Biden's announcement last week that most healthcare workers get the COVID-19. Again, they're calling it a vaccine. It's gene therapy, people. It has never ever been approved, so it's an experiment. If the mandate goes through, Brownfield Regional Medical Center CEO Jerry Jasper said that 20% or probably 20 to 25% of his staff will have to go away if that's the case. Losing the workers, he said, would likely cause the hospital to shut down. And losing Medicaid and Medicare money isn't an option either. Think about that. A White House stipulates that healthcare workers who work at hospitals and facilities that receive either Medicaid or Medicare funds will have to get the COVID-19 vaccine. It's huge in our rural communities, as all the other rural communities. We all have high poverty level and stuff like that. So a lot of medical usage in our communities and stuff like that. Another local hospital executive said that the mandate echoed Jesper's sentiments. Well, it would be devastating for the community, frankly. We have a large percentage of our revenue comes from Medicare and Medicaid kind of products. Okay, so right here in Rochester, New York, where I am, there have been regular Monday protests against the mandates. Hundreds of nursing staff and other
medical professionals at the University of Rochester, otherwise known as Strong Memorial Hospital, are going to lose their jobs based on a refusal to get the vaccine. Will Strong Memorial Hospital close? Will Rochester General close? Will your local hospital close? Because medical professionals are seeing there's a medical problem with gene by Pfizer and Moderna, because they are not, in truth, vaccines. This is the horrible, horrible truth. Keep going on. In Texas, a judge ruled that employers can mandate their employees to receive medical treatments of their choice. I want you to think about that. That's kind of appalling. Using this reason, employer can mandate you receive injections that are experimental and not proven to be safe by the FDA. Keep in mind, here the FDA has yet to approve a gene therapy as a vaccine. Hasn't yet. As of today, I checked. This includes both Pfizer and Moderna. Moderna's had a booster shot approved, but that's it. The FDA did not respond. I should say, as of yesterday, Pfizer shared the FDA's response to their plea to be approved, but the FDA didn't respond in a positive or a negative way. They simply acknowledged Pfizer's request. That's all they did. The good news on this topic of vaccine mandate was a federal judge ruled that the vaccine mandates for health workers in New York State are now temporarily blocked. Oh, yes. See, we got a new governor, but she's just doing what governor or King Andy wants. Well, we're talking, yes, about the dethroned King Andrew Cuomo. The governor, who could not keep his hands to himself, had to touch and play. And, you know, this guy's supposed to be married, and, well, he can't keep his hands to himself. Kathy Hochul had ordered healthcare workers to get the vaccine against COVID. Well, again, there is no vaccine, people. It is gene therapy. Calling it a vaccine, the reason why it's called a vaccine is they had to change the definition of vaccine. The medical definition of vaccine had to be changed so they could accept or use this term. That's a problem, people. Again, there are no FDA-approved vaccines for COVID. Wake up, America. Now, I don't have much time. I want to talk about General Miley and the charges of treasonous behavior relayed in the new book, Peril, by Bob Woodard. Greg Jarrett wrote an article on this, and I've read maybe six articles on this topic. I have a problem with what's in this book. If it is true under any circumstances, if it is true, I believe there are two people that need to immediately be arrested for treason. One of them is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. See, according to this article in Jarrett.com, the GregJarrett.com, again by Greg Jarrett, came out yesterday. The book Peril, Washington Post associate editor Bob Woodard and national political reporter Robert Costa describe in intimate detail conversations that Miley had with senior Pentagon officials, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and a top general in the Chinese military. Are you catching this? Towards the end of Trump's presidency. According to the book, Miley usurped the authority of the president as the elected civilian leader of the United States, sought to defy an order with which he disagreed, and inserted himself into a chain of command where he did not belong in order to arrogate power over the nation's military operations and nuclear codes. But that's not all. See, Nancy Pelosi charges. Now, that is insurrection. That is sedition. And by law, she should be immediately arrested. The feckless FBI claimed to be nonpartisan which we know they are not, claim to be non-political, claim to be all about enforcing the law, have no reason to be believed if they don't actively investigate and arrest these two people immediately. At the very least, these two people should be placed under guard immediately. They should be arrested and held as a danger to society. Should they be held without bail? Absolutely. Can you hold people under the charge of treason? I would think that if they both had positions of power that would allow them to exert influence, in their case, yes, they should be arrested immediately. That's my personal belief. I am not for arresting people without just cause. But here's the catch, people. All this stuff is recorded. That means we have the evidence already. We have the ability to arrest these people and put them in jail for treason. Nancy Pelosi should be charged with treason, and so should Miley. They should go to jail. They should suffer the penalty for treason. I have no questions in my mind that they are guilty, but that doesn't mean that they are. They should have a legal trial. It should be broadcast across the United States. People should see the kind of woman that Pelosi truly is and the kind of man the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff actually is. They should see this today. I have serious concerns here, people. Why are we not pressing these things? I think you should be calling your congressional representative today. Call them, actually, it's night. Call them tomorrow morning. Then I ask you, do one more thing. As of next week, I ask that you would call, I'm going to ask you to file a Freedom of Information Act. After you get every one of your friends to make that phone call too, to make that call, I'm saying calls, make them calls, make them emails under the heading treason. A request for an investigation into the treason of Nancy Pelosi and General Miley, at the very least. These actions should be done immediately, and they should be, treason and sedition. And with these charges should have these people arrested and sequestered. Now let's talk about treasonous behavior. There's one more article today that I can't let go, and I can't believe I'm going to actually get to this. This is the last article I had to share, and I'm kind of mind blown that I actually have time to get to it. Wow. This week, I don't know if you read the Washington Beacon, but I do because I consider it one of the best sources of news that's out there today. Dr. Mohammed Faghighi, an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the University of Miami in Florida, was charged this Tuesday in a Miami federal court with conspiracy to commit money laundering, unlawful export to Iran, making false statements, exporting scientific research devices to Iran without permission of the Treasury, which violates U.S. sanctions on Iran. Are these actions of treason? I personally would say yes. Again, my definition of treason is aiding and abetting the enemy. Is Iran an enemy of the United States? Well, if you listen to them, they constantly are saying, we are the great Satan. They constantly scream death to America. So if they are the enemy, and this doctor, this, quote, medical professional, has aided and abetted an enemy,
I am all for, I don't want to see such namby-pamby charges against them. I believe charges of treason should be brought. I don't think the charge of terrorism is a correct charge, ever. I think we should just go straight for the charge of treason. Because that charge has a certain penalty. It is death. When you start to put to death those who will kill your country, those who have devoted their lives to kill your government, you protect your country. We're not doing that, people. Let me read this article. It's by Kevin Daly. It came out yesterday. Aghi was born and educated in Iran. He entered the United States lawfully in 2005 and was affiliated with the university from 2013 to 2020. The university did not respond to the Washington Free Beacon's request for comment by press time. According to the criminal complaint unsealed Tuesday, a small business, operated with his wife and sister, obtained hundreds of thousands of dollars in wire service payments from companies in China, Malaysia, Singapore, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates between 2016 and 2020. Those payments allegedly financed the purchase of genetic sequencing equipment from companies in the United States. What could that be used for, people? Could it be biological warfare? See, this is why the man needs to be arrested for treason. Is he a U.S. citizen? You know what? If he's not, he's now an enemy combatant. Think about it. Export of such equipment to Iran without a license is illegal. Faghihi's exports were not authorized, and authorities allege he took pains to conceal them. Prosecutors said the wire transfers had no clear purpose, and many came around the time Faghihi procured the equipment. Those third country international wires are indicative of money laundering designed to conceal the payment originated in Iran. Federal authorities wrote in the complaint. WhatsApp messages recovered by the investigators show Faghihi communicating with multiple parties through 2017 about the sequencing devices. In May of 2017, a message he told an unnamed professor with an Iranian phone number that he had procured two sequencing devices in the United States and installed them at a lab at Shiraz University, a major research institution in southwest Iran. IP addresses for those machines confirmed they were in Shiraz from 2017, at least until June of 2021. Apart from the alleged sanctions violations, Faghihi was charged with fraudulently obtaining research grants from the National Institute of Health. As a recipient of NIH grants, Faghihi was required to disclose the wire service payments he received, but he failed to do so. Travel records indicate that Faghihi visited Iran on a regular basis, sometimes staying as long as 4 months. So again, why was he in the United States? Now, if he had come here somehow as a refugee, and he's immediately returning, that negates his original refugee status. Why was he accepted here? Those are questions that need to be asked and answered. I have a lot of issues with stuff like this. Why don't we know this information? Why is the commie, why are the commie news sources such as CNN, MSNBC, and God knows whatever else out there hiding this information? It's sad. Now, I want to share with you that there are some great, great news and news shows out there and some truth-telling shows out there. As part of Blog Talk Radio's Global Patriot Radio, we have some outstanding resources. Tomorrow we have Dr. Andrew Herod on. He'll be on around most of the all the times I'm going to tell you now are Eastern time, around 12 o'clock noon. Then you come back on Saturday, you'll hear Usama Dakdak revealing the truth about Islam. He's a great teacher, and Christy Johnson will be there. I may or may not be helping out in the background. We'll see. Time comes. Sunday. And we have, we have Chris. And Chris will be doing, Eric. We have Erica Kafiristan, and he will be doing an incredible show. Usually has debates on Sunday and reveals a lot of this stuff on Sundays and Tuesdays. He has two shows. And you'll just be mind blown with his work. Again, pay attention. His show is at 7 o'clock, usually on Tuesday, and I believe it's a little earlier, possibly 3 o'clock on Sunday. Just want to come back and listen to Black Talk Radio on that time. And on Monday, we have the Real Radio Men, Vito Esposito and Al. Or you come back, listen to the Vito Esposito show. Al will be there in the background. These are the radio professionals. Come listen. They are incredible. On Wednesday, we have Hank of Poly Sports, and then Thursday, I will be back. I have a couple of people that I might be interviewing for the next show, so please, please stay with me and join me next week. I'm going to try and keep doing this on streaming. Now, I will have Claire's video up on YouTube pretty soon. I might have it up today, or I'll have it up later this week, hopefully by the weekend. Pay attention to what's happening, people. Watch. It's time to act. It's time to no longer be silent. Now, with that said, I'm going to sign off and say goodbye to the streamers because I cannot play my broadcast music. All right. And with BTR, I want to say thank you and thank you and thank you. And here we go with courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Here Uncle Sam put your name at the top of his list, and the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list, and the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly. Oh.